Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. Hi, I am from the Dramatists Guild, where I'm the director of publications, and my primary job is that I'm the editor of the Dramatist magazine. Hold on, I have a visual aid. It's a real magazine. It is a bi-monthly magazine, and but before I get into that, I'm going to tell you a little bit about what the Dramatists Guild is, because I suspect that there may be people here who don't know. And for those of you who do know, maybe you'll learn something you didn't know before. So the Dramatists Guild was founded in 1912. In 1912, and actually at the beginning of the 20th century, authorial rights and copyright law were under siege. And all authors of all kinds of works, including novelists and poets, decided to get together because they were not always getting money for the works that were published. A work would get published, which, and you guys know what that takes to get a piece published, right? You get published, and then after you get published, another publisher would say, oh, it looks like that's gonna make some money. They would copy it and print it and not pay the author. And there was no legal recourse in this. So the writers got together. They decided that they would assemble. They formed the Authors League of America. And they very generously thought about the theater writers, because the theater writers also published their work. The theater writers came in, they joined in, they got together with the Authors League in 1912, and almost immediately they started to realize that they were not quite being represented in this group, because while the theater writers were concerned about publishing, theater writers also were concerned about producers. And producers were also trying to step in, horn in, and take over their copyright law and make money off of their work without paying them. So because they had these sort of special needs that didn't relate to publishing, they formed a subcommittee, and in 1919, 100 years ago this year, they decided to name themselves this committee. They decided to name their committee the Dramatists Guild. I think that's such a weird thing. I mean, I'm on a committee, and it's called the Publications Committee. I mean, it's rather prosaic, but still, I don't understand how you form a committee and then you're like, we're going to call ourselves the Dramatists Guild. I don't get where that came from exactly. I think it's a really peculiar thing. But what happened was that eventually they ended up splitting off from the Authors League because their needs were so very specific and very different. And they already had the name established. So it just moved from being a committee to an actual organization in 1926. I think that I've got the years right. Google it. You'll tell me if I'm wrong. So the Dramatists Guild, there are two words in that title that I want to talk about because there are two antiquated words there. The first being dramatist. If you look it up in the dictionary, dramatist is basically just a synonym for playwright, but it was antiquated even in 1912. No one was really using that word. So the theater writers, as they were assembling and talking about how they could really stick together, it doesn't just include playwrights. It's also lyricists, librettists, and composers. And so they were looking for a collective noun that would describe the group of theater writers, and they decided to sort of reach back in time to this forgotten word, dramatist, and reclaim it as the collective noun for all theater writers. That's where that came from. And it's still an antiquated word. But there it is. That's what they decided to do, and that's what we have. Over the years, the Dramatists Guild has formed a lot of other organizations, and weirdly, those other organizations have carried the word dramatist along with it, which is so strange. Dramatist Play Service, some of you know this publishing company, was founded at the Dramatists Guild in 1936, and they stuck that name dramatist right on there. So they've good with branding is what I'm here to tell you. We have 8,000 members across the country. And then there's the word guild. And I want to talk about the word guild because there are other organizations that you probably have heard of that use the word guild. Screen Actors Guild, Writers Guild of America. And those are neither one of those are actually guilds. They maybe were once upon a time, but since then they decided to become unions. So here's the deal. A union, by definition, is to protect protect employees from employers. But a guild is a trade association, similar to a union, but different because guild members are no one's employee. They own their work, always. And therefore, if any one of you should have a Broadway production, for instance, that Broadway producer is not your boss. You are always the boss. And that's why we exist. Is to make sure that everybody knows you own your work, you call the shots, you created it when no one else was there, it's your thing, right? It's property. So yay, that's all I think I have to say about the nerdy land of the Dramatists Guild. Does anybody have any questions for me about what the hell that is, what I just said, other than we have 8,000 members? Thanks for asking. No? Good. Yeah?
Requirements for joining the guild.
Wow. Okay, so the short answer is visit our website, please. good. There are a number, it depends on which level you're entering at, but basically it's that you have written a play. That's basically it. There are a couple of other little things in there. If you are joining as like an associate member or a student on the student level, I think it is just that you have written a play. If you're coming in as a member, which is a little bit higher fee, it means that you have had, you've either been published or produced. And that's, I guess there's other stuff. Please visit the website and please don't quote me on this podcast. Oh my God, it's a podcast. They're gonna track me down. They're gonna garnish my wages for getting this wrong. Anyway, yes, that's my short answer. Visit the website. Cool, does anybody else have any questions? Yeah. Yeah. Right. Kind of yes and no. We're a little bit hamstrung by the legal definition of what we're allowed to do. So kind of. The guild sent me here today. This is a little bit of networking, getting to know this theater, getting to know this community. Lots of theater is produced outside of New York City. Really, right now, all the good theater is being produced outside of New York City. Really, it's so true. It's absolutely true. Anything that's being produced in New York that's any damn good started outside of New York. That's the word. And most people don't understand or realize that, but that's the truth. We're a national organization. We're always trying to reach out. We're always trying to connect people with each other. So the answer is kind of, but we don't have a formalized method of connecting people to each other. There are privacy laws and all kinds of boring things that I'm not going to get into that, you know, can I share your email address? I don't know. Can you? I mean, it's a thing. But as often as we can, yes, we do. Yeah, does anybody else have any questions? Those are good ones. Those are tough ones. I wasn't even prepared for either one. I should be for the membership thing I'll get better. Great. Okay, so the magazine. So, you know, writers love ink on paper. They love lots of things, but ink on paper is like kind of the thing, right? I mean, it's permanent. They like that much better than pixels on a screen, which doesn't seem to be super permanent. A long time ago, they started to write this, all the guild members were writing this newsletter, and this newsletter started to just like get longer and longer and longer and longer. And finally, in 1964, they turned it into a quarterly journal that was much beloved and looks a little bit like it might have been printed in a church basement. It's adorable. I love them. It's super dry. It's like really, it's just black and white. And they hired an illustrator from The New Yorker to do like little doodles and things in it, which is so cute. And then in 1989, they felt like they'd outgrown that. And so they became a standard 8.5 by 11 magazine that is printed now bimonthly, so every other month. It is written entirely by members for members. However, because it is what it is also the only national publication dedicated to the business and craft of writing for theater. It is the most specific magazine I have ever encountered. And it is so specific that that I think I'm the only person in the world right now who could do this job, because it hits every single thing I love. I love writers, I love them dearly, and I love artists, and I get to work with both. It's the best. I have the best job ever. So basically what I do is I corral people who are guild members, and we come up with a theme. We have a publications committee, or now what I'm going to start calling it, the Publications Guild. And we come up with the themes. Sometimes they'll pitch a few ideas, and I'll bounce it off various people, and we'll see what we come up with. Anyway, in January, we came out with the community issue. So that's why I'm holding this up. And right before we did this issue, probably a year, I guess, before we did this issue, I started doing The Dramatist Live. And they sent me to Arkansas, Arizona, and Montana. You know, the hotbeds of theater culture. And I started in Arkansas because I'm from Arkansas originally, and I have failed there so many times that I thought, well, if I stand in front of people and fail, I'm used to it. It's fine. I've done it many times. And so, therefore, that's what I did. It didn't fail, but anyway, it's, yeah, it was good. It was really good. There's some amazing stuff going on there. And then I went to Arizona, and I went to Montana, and they're also doing amazing work there in both of those states. And then we came back and we put together the community issue. And one of the things that I asked the writers at all three of those states, is actually the first question I'm going to ask these writers tonight. But before I do that, I'm going to turn around and have them all introduce themselves to you. Will you guys just please, by the way, these are all writers, as I think everybody in here knows. These are all writers from the festival. So starting with you, Clyde, will you just say your name and the play that you wrote?
Good evening, Clyde Santana, and my play was Oops.
Benita Elaine, The Spirit of Abolition.
Jean Klein, Generous Rivals.
Teddy Holmes, Water for Poets.
Fantastic, thank you. Thank you all. So my question, this is a tough one, so I just want you to like relax, take it in. This is the question that I asked in three states, and I got the most interesting answers after usually a long silence. And that is, what do you think a writer's responsibility is to their community? And you can answer in any order if anybody comes up with anything.
I can give you a personal one.
Yeah, that's great.
Okay, and for me as a writer, I think it's to represent the voices in the community in which I live, which are not represented by mass media. The voices that are not heard, those are the ones that I look for.
Yeah. Does anybody else have something?
For me, I write because I have to. It's the thing that is the gift that God gave to me, and it's the thing that burns the brightest inside of me that I have to get out. I have to write. And when I do write, I have a responsibility to make sure that what I write is for everybody, not so exclusive. So even what I write, my girls can read it and not have to, you don't have to worry about language or a situation or anything like that. That's my responsibility.
Nice, thanks.
I think it's an extension of when we were kids, we played in a sandbox. And in that sandbox, we told stories. And I think that as we grow older, we still have sandboxes in our minds. And so we still need to tell stories, and other people who've forgotten how to play in that sandbox now get a chance to play in the sandbox with us when we tell those stories. And they can laugh, cry, or walk out and say, wow.
Great, thanks.
And I think, yes, we do write to represent the voices of those that are unheard. And I think the people also look to writers and artists for answers, for some sort of hope. So in essence, writers are almost like this prophetic voice, mm-hmm. almost. So, yeah.
Nice. It's so interesting. You know, in other places where I've asked this question, it was interpreted without me doing anything differently, because I asked the question the same way, that I meant the other, like the community of writers. Like, what is your responsibility to other writers? And it's so interesting that no one here really said that. You all are talking about your entire community. It's not just the community of writers. I find that really interesting. And I think that's reflected in everything that I'm seeing at this festival. It's everything in this theater. It's the stuff that I'm seeing around town. Clyde took me for a little tour today, and we went over to Norfolk, and I saw it at the university, and it is exactly what it's bubbling up here. And that's why, by the way, my office sent me here today. So I'm so happy to report such great stuff when I go back. Okay, so in the magazine, some of you know this, most of you don't. because you probably have never seen this magazine before. We have a regular feature that's called 10 Questions. We're not going to ask all 10 questions tonight. I think we're just going to do 4 this evening. But we're going to do it a little bit differently because this isn't in print. So I'm going to pass a question. Don't read it out loud yet. You can read it, just don't read it out loud. Around. That's yours.
Thanks, Joey.
Sure. having technical difficulties here.
It's a sign. Yeah.
That's yours. Okay. So here's what we're going to do. Hi. Hello. I'm coming to you this way. Oh, look, it's like Phil Donahue. Oh, that was a really old reference, wasn't it? Yeah, oh, well, okay, yeah. My glasses were red, I'd be Sally Jesse. Hi, I'm Joey, what's your name?
ML.
ML, you're going to be number one. Okay. Hi, what's your name?
Eddie.
Hi, Eddie, you're gonna be number two. Okay. Wait, I'm coming over here. Hi, tell everybody your name.
Gail.
Hi, Gail. Will you be number three? Okay, fantastic. And Richard?
My name's Richard.
Yeah, hi. Will you be number four? Okay, fantastic. Okay, Clyde Santana, will you ask number one? Tell us your name again.
ML.
Will you ask her your question?
Yes. What was your most memorable theatrical experience as a child?
Oh, wait, I'm not doing my job right. I'm coming.
The first thing I ever saw was an adaptation of a short story called Occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge. And I remember reading that story before actually seeing the adaptation of it and could not imagine how anybody on stage would be able to perform the ending. And if anyone isn't familiar with this particular short story, it's about a man who has escaped from being imprisoned, and I believe it's Civil War. And while he is escaping from his captors, it's this amazing story about how he goes through the briars and the forest, and he crosses the river, and he does everything because he was just about to be hung by them. But of course, when he was about to be hung, the rope snapped and he fell into the river, and this was how he was escaping. And just as he gets to the very end of it, the way that the actual author in writing the short story was, it snaps us right back into where his neck gets broken. And the entire thing was his final moment where he thought he had gotten free. So the one thing that I saw on stage was how they were able to put that short story, not only make it from this very first person point of view into something theatrical, but they were also able to show how he snapped his neck, but still show him trying to be free at the same time. And I think that was the first thing that actually shook me, and that something that I had already imagined very in my own mind and reading the power of someone's literature, but then also being able to take that into a play, and how now they've taken away what I was imagining and put those actual images in front of me and used the words and the images together as that adaptation.
Nice, I wanna see it. Yeah. That's great. Okay, Clyde, now you have to answer the question yourself.
Well, I was a teenager really when I saw it, because most of the stuff that I saw that the schools brought me to when I was a kid, we saw some stuff that Leonard Bernstein, when he was directing. But when I was a teenager in college, I saw a play called Santicity. And I remember it was a young man who was relating his experiences, and we finally found out that he was actually in an asylum at the end. Mm. And it was a surrealistic piece, a short one act, but they performed it at and that was really my first time seeing a play, because I didn't see a lot in New York when I was a kid. So that was, and after that, I kind of began to write a little bit more and eventually started writing plays.
That's great. Yeah, theater's expensive in New York, no matter what era or time that you're living in. It's just always expensive. Benita, you have question number two.
Indeed, I do.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Would you ask number two your question?
What production do you wish you would have seen?
What production do you wish you would have seen?
What production do I wish I would have seen? Just yeah.
If there's any that you never saw that you're like, oh, I wish I would have seen that one.
What came to mind immediately was a production of Starlight Express. I would have loved to have seen how it's such a ridiculous story anyway, and then to have them all perform the show on roller skates I think it was the 70s, I guess. I've heard about this show. I've never read the book. No, I don't even know the music, but I just know that this entire show was on roller skates, and it was about trains, I think.
Yes.
that's a production I would have loved to have seen.
Same. And Jane Krakowski was in it.
Really?
Yeah, can you imagine? What? I mean, it's kind of perfect. Jane Krakowski on roller skates, pretending to be a train. I'm there. I just sold me a ticket. Right there. That's a good one. Amazing. Okay, Benita, what production do you wish you would have seen?
There is a documentary of Raul Julia. And I would have loved to have seen The Taming of the Shrew with him and Meryl Streep.
Oh, yeah.
They showed bits of it on PBS, and I was like, I wish I could have been there. It was phenomenal. I understand it was free. It was like theater
That's right.
in the park.
That's right.
And from the documentary, it was awesome, and everybody who's seen it still talks about it.
Yeah.
They loved it.
Yeah. Yeah, me too. Sign me up for that. I want to see that too. Okay, Jean, you have number three.
Okay, and who is number three? Who am I going to?
Gail.
Oh, it's Gail.
It's Gail.
Okay, who was the person who made the biggest impact on your career?
No pressure.
Oh, hmm.
Should I say except Clyde?
Hmm. Oh, that's a good question. My career has taken different twists and turns, mm-hmm. and so I have to really think about, and at each of those twists and turns, there were different people who, I think there's, let me think now, and this is not, and I guess this was maybe halfway through. One of the women that I most admired, when I did not think, she turned out to be, ended up being one of my supervisors who hired me. And I didn't think that she was going to hire me. I really didn't. And yet, during the interview, we laughed and talked about all kinds of different things. And so, and yet I still didn't think she was going to hire me. And then she did. And that was a job where I stayed the longest. And it was, I really admired her, and I still do. She was just elegant and funny and just and kind, but a real solid leader. You know, if things weren't going the right way, she didn't hesitate to tell you, but she did it in a kind way so that you, no matter how hard it was to hear, you still would, yes, okay, I'll fix it, I'll change it, I'll get it right, that sort of thing. And I think she had the most impact on my career because of the way I would approach things. I learned so much from her about how to approach things and how to think about things and how to stay even with things. I never thought about that in terms of who had the most, the greatest impact, but I would say her name is Inez, and I would say it was Inez.
All right, Inez. That's good. Thanks. Yeah. Okay, Jean.
Okay.
What's your answer?
I'm going to have to cheat and have two.
Of course.
And neither one is both are gone now. But one was my very first playwriting mentor at the University of Iowa many, many years ago. And I was lucky enough to study with him when he was just really beginning his career. And he went on, Howard Stein. I don't know that anybody in this room would know that name, but he went on from there to become head of the playwriting department at Yale, and then went on to become dean at Columbia. And his voice is still in my head today because we continue to communicate from the time that I studied with him all through his life. He died when he was close to 90. And little things keep coming back into my head, like he would say, always have something in the trunk. You know, don't ever get caught when somebody says, now what's your next play about? Always know what it is. He called me one day. I continued to send him scripts occasionally, and he called me about this script that I had sent him. This was maybe 8 years ago, and he said, well, Jeannie, he said, I always knew you were going to write a great play one day, and now you have half of one. And, you know, because of his advice on this play and somebody else at the American Theater over in Hampton, I never could get the second act and finally did because he stood his ground with that. And the other is probably my husband, who told me over 40 years ago, he was doing his dissertation on Samuel Johnson, and he said, you have to write a play about this woman, Hester Thrale, which is the play that you saw if you were here last night. I struggled with it for years and years and years, and it was Clyde who kind of got me writing that play again through the Dream Rights program here at the theater. And but if he had never said to me, you have to write about this woman called Hester Thrale, I never would have even tried to do it. It's plagued me for 40 years, and I'm sitting here now saying, I paid my debt to my late husband. So those are the people who have influenced me.
That's great. Okay, Teddy, you have number four.
All right.
All right, Richard, I'm coming to you.
All right, Richard. If you could be anyone, past, present, or past, present, or fictional, for one day, who would you be and why?
You can do this.
It's a tough one.
Yeah.
Let's go with the great brain, because you've probably never heard of the great brain. When I was in elementary school, the thing that got me into reading, and I became a prolific reader, was was a series of books called The Great Brain. I don't even remember who wrote them. I think they were written sometime in the late 1800s. And it was just, it was about this this little kid who was this con man. And he just had so much fun in the world, you know, conning adults and having, you know, just having fun in the world. And I just remember just kind of sort of living through him and the fun, the kind of sort of harmless fun that he had, just kind of like trickery and genius and very, very clever stuff. It's just stuck with me.
Was that his name? Did he name himself the Great Brain? How did that happen?
It was the title of the. It was. Oh, was even in Utah? Oh, that's where I grew up. Okay. Interesting.
Amazing. That's cool. I didn't know anything about that. Yeah. Nice. And look, we all have computers in our pockets, and we can look these things up. That's so fancy. Hi. What's your answer?
The same thing, actually. I'm just kidding.
Yeah. Wouldn't that be great?
Same thing.
Well, did you grow up in Utah?
Who knows? But no, yeah, this is a tough one. I was thinking, though, out of so many, I'd go with, for now, James Earl Jones.
Oh, my God.
Because I just want to know how it feels to live in that voice. Like, I read his autobiography, and I was, you know, hooked, you know, immediately. And a lot of, we had a lot of the same, some similar things to happen to us in our upbringing, and I'm just like, wow, he is such an incredible artist. And it was, and all of those experiences, they didn't inhibit his voice. You know, he still has this massive, big voice, and I say live in because a voice like that, you know, it just kind of encapsulates you. You know, so James Earl Jones.
I love that. Okay, this is a weird digression, and it's a little name-droppy, but I'm sorry about that. So I have a James Earl Jones story that relates to his voice. This is so weird. I love that I can tell this. My first job, my day job when I moved to New York, was working in Circle in the Square Theater. And my boss, Ted Mann, one of the founders of Circle in the Square, employed James Earl Jones several times. He even did a production of Othello that was famously James. So they remained in touch, and Ted Mann was very old when I was working for him, and he was in the process of writing his memoirs. And so he was reaching out to people to do a little bit of fact-checking. And so he asked me, because I was the assistant, if I would contact people with these questions. And some people he allowed me to talk to, and some people I was not allowed to talk to. James Earl Jones was one of them I was not allowed to talk to. So I got it, I called, and it went to voicemail immediately. And so I left a message, and then my boss was furious that I left a message. I want to leave in the message. I was like, okay, great, fine, I'll call him back. So we called back, he left a message. And maybe 10 minutes later, my boss was out of the building, and the phone rings, and I pick it up, and he says, hey, it's Jimmy Jones. I swear to God, his voice was that high, and it was super fast and really excited. And I was like,
wow.
Jimmy Jones? It didn't even occur to me that this was the same person. He says, hey, Ted Mann called. I'm just calling him back. Right? And so I had a conversation with him, and his whole voice was way up here in this register the whole time. I'm so excited to talk to Ted. What's he doing? He's writing his memoirs. That's so great. I was like, this is Darth Vader? This is CNN?
That's encouraging to me.
Isn't that nuts? I know. He steps into that. He does have range. He does.
I like that.
Yeah. Okay, so we're going to stick with you, and we're going to work our way back down towards Clyde. Everybody up here, they have work in this festival, which is really exciting. And so I'm just going to ask you all to give us your short synopsis about the piece that you're doing in this festival. Mm-hmm. Teddy, yours is tomorrow, correct?
Tomorrow, yeah.
Tomorrow, okay, great. So this is the thing that's going to entice everybody here to get off their butts and come and see your show tomorrow. Got it?
Okay.
And the other three plays are all being done on Saturday, so you can binge watch all three of the other plays in one day, which is amazing. So this is how we're going to get people to come. You got it?
Got it.
Okay, tell us.
All right. Water for Poets is the story about a young poet who learns to harness the power of his words. He visits people through the dream world and is able to make an impact and able to connect with them through the dream world. But he finds that his adventures are not so simple. So will he give in? Will he give up? I don't know. You should come and see tomorrow night at 10 o'clock.
Perfect. That was very well done. Thanks. Jean?
I'm collecting names and addresses at the door, and we'll hunt you down if you don't. basically, the play is about a woman by the name of Hester Thrill, which I've already told you. She's basically a 21st century woman in an 18th century world. And newly widowed, she kind of pins her hopes on her friendship and her her own wit in friendship with Samuel Johnson and writing his biography, because her goal for herself is to become a raconteur, a woman of society, someone who is well known in literary circles, essentially one of the blue stockings. And she has a rival in the form of James Boswell, who is his well-known biographer now. She's not. And so they establish a kind of rivalry, and he tries to blindside her. And he does so in a way that changes her life forever. And if you want to find out what that change is, I'll see you Saturday.
Perfect. Jean, will you tell us the title of your play?
Oh, I'm sorry. It's Generous Rivals.
Generous Rivals. It's such a good title. We were talking about that last night. Titles are tough. Yeah. We were just, I mean, we all had that moment of nodding. Yes, titles.
This play has had 150 titles.
Oh, wow.
Okay, Benita, tell us the title of your play that just happened, and make us all come back for Saturday.
Well, it's called The Spirit of Abolition. There in the country now, there's this conflict back and forth. Should the Confederate monuments stay? Should the Confederate monuments go? In May 2017, in Norfolk's Johnny Reb Monument, somebody sprayed shame on it. Nobody knows who did it. So my play is based on, like, this Norfolk State University student happens to be there on the night it was sprayed. She didn't do it, but she was arrested for doing it. And this gets the attention of the descendants of the abolitionists of the 1800s. So they come in to help her situation. And you have to find out what happens by coming back on Saturday at 3. That's me.
Thanks. Clyde, will you tell us the title of your play and then what it means?
Yeah, it's my play was called OOPS, and that stands for Optical Online Peering System. And in a world where, there are three lonely roommates who share a small room, one room, kind of a closet-sized apartment. And they discover this site, which has gorgeous-looking men. But the thing is this a window into a world that is real, or is it a scam? And so that's the story of OOPS. And we see where those characters, all three of them, go as they are crammed in one little closet-sized room. And they're trying to figure out how they're going to find their significant others.
Great, thank you. I am so impressed that that this theater has as built into its mission that it supports new work and nurturing artists of many stripes here. And I'm particularly encouraged that I think everybody here is local, right? Do you all live here or near here?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because I was saying when I first arrived, no theater nationally is really making this commitment. It's not just unique for your area. It's not just unique for your state. It's unique in this country. And I think it's really admirable. To everybody who's working in this theater, I just want to thank you all for being here and for being part of this mission. I'm encouraged. I'm really encouraged. And I think it's really terrific that you all have a place where your work is being put up in front of an audience. I mean, it's the piece that a playwright prays for in order to complete and continue their work. You've got to get the audience hearing it and seeing what's being reacted to and what's not, so that you can continue to do your work. It's vital to what you do, and I'm so pleased to see that you all have given them this platform.
And could I give one last plug to the Dramatists Guild, please?
Yeah, sure. You sure may.
I've been a member for goodness knows how many years. They do more than send us a magazine and send us opportunities. And tell me if I'm wrong that they don't do this anymore, but their legal department has been extremely helpful to me. I've encouraged everybody that I know that writes to join, because you can contact their legal department and they will get back to you. And there is one publishing company out there that regularly sends out contracts and has sent them to people that I know. And in the contract, it says, we also buy your copyright. Well, I'm sorry, you just never sell that. You never sell that. And if you go to them and say, I don't want to do that, I'll cut it out, and all you have to do is send a contract to them, and they'll review it for you and tell you what to X out so that you're not selling away rights that you should not be selling in that contract. So I just wanted to give them a plug for that, as
Thank
well
you.
As sending out opportunities.
Thank you. Yeah, that's the thing that I think the Guild probably does best. We do lots of things pretty well, but that's the thing we do best.
Yeah.
We review all your contracts. All you have to do is send them. Don't sign them first.
Exactly.
Then we can't do anything with that. But we do that. And
big help.
Yeah, thanks, Jean. That's really sweet. I have one last question for each of you before we go. Clyde, let's start with you. We'll work our way back this way. What are you working on now?
I'm working on a trilogy of that's based on the life of a artist, you know, who has found various jobs in his life, and I'm going through the stages from several years ago to the time when he retires, to the time when he starts a new job, and actually the last part of it will be to when he's leaving this world. And you know, we talked about, this is really funny because I was talking to Joey this afternoon, and he said, and I said, well, there's a part in it about painting. And he said, Clyde, make them paint on stage. And I thought about it, and I said, huh? He said, let the piece live. Let the audience see. And he mentioned another piece about Vlasco, and he said, but they didn't paint. Let them paint on stage while they're doing it. And it's a piece called, When Walls Speak, Dreams Don't Fade. And so I thought about it, and I said, and then he said, I'll come see it if they paint on stage. And I said, wow. I said, but we just had a good time talking about it. So I'm thinking about going home when I get home and I have some time to do this. I'm going to start working on, they're going to paint on stage.
That's exciting. Yay. Okay, Benita, tell me what you're working on.
Honestly, Joey?
Yeah.
There's a lot of things going on in my head right now.
Are there really?
I have so many stories up there.
What's the one that's knocking, trying to get out right this minute?
I really don't know. I think it's called The Spirit of Abolition.
Yeah, of course. Rewrites. That's a thing.
That's what I think it is.
Yeah, of course.
So I'm just going to say The Spirit of Abolition.
I think that's terrific. Yeah. Yeah, virtually everyone I talk to, they will all say that the whole gig of writing is rewriting. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely it. Okay, Jean, what are you working on?
Okay, well, again, I'm going to echo Benita, because I think probably will be a rewrite and several hundred more of Generous Rivals, but that's kind of over with. The shape is there. The one that's knocking at my head now is one that Clyde has kind of pushed at me to do. I happened to tell him a story. It's always a mistake to tell Clyde a story because he tells you to turn it into a play. And I told him a story about a young girl that I had met when I was running a partial hospitalization program for a community mental health center, and I had a day program for children. And there was a young girl who came to me. There wasn't really anything wrong with her. She just kind of needed to get out of the house after school, I think. And I was never particularly motherly when I was younger. You know, I love my own kid. I love my grandkid. But aside from that, I don't think of myself as one of these women who goes around and picks up babies. Oh, isn't that cute? You know, that just was never an interest. But there was something about this girl, and if I'm honest, I think it's maybe that she reminded me of me. And she came to me for, quote, counseling. She didn't need counseling. She just needed somebody to talk to. So she would come in the afternoon, and she came in one afternoon, and she was upset. And I said, well, you know, what's wrong? She was maybe 8 or 9, and she had a wonderful, loving grandpa, just loved grandpa. And her grandma was one of these really strict, looking for dirt under the carpet, you know, anything she could find that was wrong. And she crawled up on my lap, which is something you're not supposed to do in therapy. But I said, what the hell? There's nothing wrong with her anyway. So I sat there, and she said, my grandpa bought me a dog 3 days ago. And I said, oh, that's nice. She said, yeah, but my grandma got rid of it today. And I said, geez, you know, just the idea of this beautiful child, and I was gonna take her home. I was gonna go out. We were gonna go buy clothes for her. I was gonna decorate a room in my house. You know, that was not gonna happen. This was what 1970s. I'm white. She was a mixed race child, had a family. Well, you know what? Sure, I'm going to take her home. And 2 weeks later, she disappeared. And I knew everybody in the Berkeley section of Norfolk. I knew people who knew more people than I knew, and I could never find out what happened to this little girl. And I still think about her, you know, often, and wonder what happened to her. Her mother was pretty much on the streets. Homeless, drug addicted, whatever. And I always wonder what happened to Deidre, and if anything I had ever done made any difference in her life and where she was now, and if she ever knew how much I cared about her. I want to write that play. What it's going to look like, I don't have a clue. But it was funny that you asked that question, because when I was walking here tonight, I said, I'm going to tell Clyde I'm going to write the play.
That's great. I look forward to seeing it.
I hope you will.
Thanks. Okay, Teddy, what else are you working on?
excuse me. I am working on two autobiographical pieces, two identity plays. One is called The Beautiful Man, and it's all in light of the journey that I've started recently. So I grew up in a very strict household, and I hated my father growing up. But when you forgive, you know, that opens up a whole new door. And so I've started asking questions about my dad. And I'm finding out so much about not only my dad, but my grandfathers, my uncles, great-great-grandfathers. And it is blowing my mind. And so at the end of the day, I can, the hope is that I can see the beauty, you know, in all of these men in my life. I'm also working on a piece called Purple. It's about a journey of a young man who's navigating some serious issues in his young life. He lives in the South in an emasculating environment, and it's tough. And that's been my story. You know, everybody's always had their concern and their worry about me. You know, they want you to be overtly this or overtly that, you know. And so it's called Purple, and I look forward to developing both of those.
That sounds great. Thank you all for being here tonight. Thank you for participating in this with me. And thank you all for being here. I appreciate it. Please come back. Come back and support this.
Thanks,
Thank you. I have copies of the magazine up here. If anybody wants one to take home, just come talk to me. I only have like four, but I'm happy to hand them out. Thank you.
May I have one?
Oh. Yeah, of course.